Hey there, friends. A quick favor. We are conducting a brief audience survey. We'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes to provide your answers. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to complete it. That's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you.
Pope Francis will soon become the first pope to visit Iraq. He'll be greeted by a huge poster with a quote from a 7th century Muslim leader.
And the quote is, "People are of two kinds. They are either your brothers in faith or your equals in humanity."
Also today, there's a growing movement among environmentally conscious companies removing as much carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as they put in, going back decades.
How the hell do we know how much CO2 we produced in 1964? So we developed a huge methodology to do that.
And before envelopes, how did you keep a letter private? You locked it.
And that is when you take a piece of paper and you fold it up and you secure it so it becomes its own envelope.
Nifty. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In Myanmar today, defiance. Hundreds of mourners chanted slogans and also paid their respects to a 19-year-old woman known as Angel. Yesterday, she was shot in the head and killed in Myanmar's second-largest city, Mandalay. Angel was wearing a shirt that read, "Everything will be okay." A photo taken just before she was killed is widely making the rounds online. In all, security forces killed at least 38 people nationwide yesterday, the bloodiest single day since Myanmar's coup began 1 month ago. As the situation worsens in Myanmar, pressure is mounting on Washington to do something to stop the violent crackdown. Dan Slater directs the Wiser Center for Emerging Democracies at the University of Michigan, and he joins me now from Ann Arbor. Dan, bring us up to speed on events in Myanmar this week. What happened in Mandalay yesterday?
So I'm not on the ground in Mandalay, obviously, but basically the way this has been going is that the police and military seem to be especially repressive in Mandalay. That's where some of the worst confrontations have been happening.
How widespread are the protests against this military coup?
They're nationwide. They're enormous. You can see the pictures from the major cities. They're all around the country. You know, this is not the kind of protest movement which splits a country and where you see a big part of the population that backs the government and a big part that doesn't, you know, like we saw in Egypt and Thailand, for instance. This is really one where the people of Myanmar came out and they voted. They voted in droves for the National League of Democracy political party. Those elections have been thrown in the waste bin, and we're seeing the response.
Do the protests reach across generations? I mean, do you have, 15, 60-year-olds out there as well as 20-year-olds?
You sure do. I think it's completely cross-cutting. And as is often the case with these things, it's certainly the youth are, you know, playing a leading role. But it's certainly not simply, you know, the grudges of the young. This is something where, you know, the country was under military rule for 50 years. They've had 10 years to have more civilian input into politics. And, you know, as I said, the plug has been pulled. And, you know, the people of Myanmar are just not going back to the status quo ante anytime soon.
Now, this crisis in Myanmar, it's an early one that the Biden administration has to kind of respond to.
Right.
And how has it responded?
Well, it's responded, you know, certainly, I think, very clearly in rhetorical terms, in terms of not accepting what the military has done, demanding a reversal of the coup. And, you know, I think they've been steadfast and trying to lead the way with the United Nations and in terms of international partners in making sure there's a united international front against this kind of power grab.
But they also have imposed sanctions on some Myanmar military, haven't they?
Yes, that's right.
What's the direct impact of those?
Well, so literally there are things like moving towards arms embargoes. These are things like freezing the assets of leading figures within the military. It's things like cutting off investments toward military-linked businesses, which are very prominent in Myanmar. So the idea is here is try not to go back to the old world of sanctions where the whole country was sort of punished for the sins of the military and try to do that in a much more focused, laser-like way just to affect the fortunes of those who are most directly responsible for the coup.
What else do you think the Biden administration needs to do?
I think the main thing is to try to keep the focus on international solidarity. You know, one good thing at the moment is that there's really nobody no major power in the world that wants to see this coup happen or that wants to see it succeed. This isn't in China's interest. It's not in the interest of the regional organization, ASEAN, in Southeast Asia. And so I think the United States can really work with, you know, other countries in trying to keep a united front. And I think really keeping the focus on not just democracy, but a return to stability.
Dan Slater is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan. He's been updating us on events in Myanmar and the foreign policy response by the Biden administration. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Carol.
Tomorrow, Pope Francis is heading to Iraq for a 3-day tour of the country. He's scheduled to meet with Christian leaders as well as the prominent Shia cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. This marks the first time a pope has ever visited Iraq, but his visit does come with some controversy. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
Online videos show streets of the holy city of Najaf in central Iraq getting a much-needed facelift. City workers are sprucing up a main boulevard in town, adding a fresh coat of paint to the curb, filling up potholes and putting up banners. Haidar Al-Khoi is with the Al-Khoi Institute in Najaf, an Islamic seminary and an interfaith academy. He's been watching the preparations in recent weeks.
One of the first signs that the Pope is going to see as soon as he steps off the plane is a huge poster draped along the airport with a picture of Pope Francis and Ayatollah Sistani with a famous quote from Imam Ali, a 7th century Muslim leader. And the quote is, "People are of two kinds. They are either your brothers in faith or your equals in humanity."
Khoi says the Pope's visit is historic, not just for the residents of Najaf, a center for Shia Islam, but for Iraqis all over the country.
They see it as a recognition not just of Iraq's rich history, religious significance, and demographic diversity, but also of the pivotal role the country can and should play in building bridges between communities across the region and across the world.
Pope Francis has a packed itinerary. Over 3 days, he'll visit Baghdad, Najaf, the ancient site of Ur, birthplace of Abraham, and then several other places in northern Iraq. The Nineveh Plains, where the Pope will visit, is home to several minority groups, including Christians. Church bells chime in the city of Mosul in northern Iraq. This is from a video posted online. It shows St. Thomas Church, one of several churches in and around the city. Northern Iraq was once a thriving center for Christian communities. There are 14 officially recognized Christian denominations in Iraq. Things changed after the US-led invasion in 2003. That sparked sectarian violence that was devastating to Christian communities. Many Iraqi Christians fled the country. Then came the rise of the Islamic State in 2014. The group terrorized Christians and other minorities in Iraq.
Christians, as other members, like communities, have suffered from the conflict and also the displacement. Many of their villages and their cities have been destroyed.
Hassan Amr Abdullah works for the Catholic Relief Services in the city of Duhok in the Kurdish region. He says people in his city are tired of war and insecurity, so the Pope's visit is a welcomed morale boost.
It's important for the entire communities that the evil does not have the last word here in Iraq, and the Pope did not forget about them.
Abdullah Al-Awhad shares the same sentiments. He's an 18-year-old resident of Mosul. He has curly hair and wears round glasses. He tells me his family fled the city when the Islamic State came. He was 12 years old at the time.
I stayed in Bahrain for around 3 years and then I came back to Mosul.
When he returned, he says, much of the city was destroyed.
It really looked different. It was pale. I almost didn't recognize some places in the city.
Today, Mosul is slowly recovering, he says. People are rebuilding their homes as well as churches and mosques. Awhad, who is a Muslim, says he has many Christian friends and he's delighted that the Pope will come and see the rebirth of Mosul for himself. Pope Francis spoke about his visit to Iraq this week. He described his planned meetings with religious leaders in Iraq as a way to strengthen ties between different faiths. The Pope has come under some scrutiny for traveling during the pandemic. He has been vaccinated, but many in Iraq have not. The Vatican's ambassador to the country tested positive recently for COVID-19. Another concern is security. Militia groups in Iraq have fired rockets recently at areas that used to be safe. But Masroor Barzani, the prime minister of the Kurdish region, says Iraqis are ready.
We are taking all the precautionary measures to provide maximum security for His Holiness's visit to our region.
The pontiff will be accompanied by members of the Swiss Guards. They are the protection force responsible for the Pope's safety. And the 84-year-old will ride in an armored car instead of the Pope mobile. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Now to Ethiopia. It's been exactly 4 months since the conflict began in Ethiopia's Tigray region. This week, the United Nations said it has corroborated reports of atrocities in Tigray committed by multiple parties. Some may constitute war crimes. Today, the UN Security Council is having a closed-door meeting to discuss the ongoing crisis. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, has been reporting on this story from Nairobi, Kenya. Halima, we continue to hear alarming reports about atrocities in Tigray. What is alleged to have happened and by whom?
Unfortunately, the reports of atrocities is very grim, and they range from looting to extrajudicial killings to rape and to indiscriminate shellings. And no party in this conflict has escaped these allegations, from the Ethiopian Federal Forces to the Tigray People's Liberation Front to Eritrean troops who are alleged to be fighting in Tigray. And it seems like, honestly, every week the atrocities and the accusations get worse. Last week, Amnesty International released a report investigating atrocities in Aksum and found that Eritrean troops had massacred hundreds of civilians, and that the Ethiopian government forces had been indiscriminately shelling, or at least this is what the report alleged. Recently, I spoke with a lawyer from Tigray who's since escaped and is now seeking asylum in Nairobi. His name is Teshegar Tsigab Gebremeskel, and this is what he had to say about what he saw in Tigray.
Some people who are close friends with me died in that situation in Tigray. I know some families who are dead, and I see corpses lying on the streets.
And now the UN is calling for access on the ground so that it can conduct independent investigations into these alleged atrocities. And recently this week, the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, called for the same when he was speaking with Ethiopia's Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed.
What has the Ethiopian government's response been to that pressure for access?
It's been improving recently, if you compare it to the beginning of the crisis, where the UN had very limited access, where journalists had very limited access. And when it comes to kind of the humanitarian rights violations, this is what the spokesperson of Ethiopia's Foreign Affairs Ministry, Dina Mufti, had to say.
The Ethiopian government is committed to the human rights issues, and the government is committed to carry out independent investigation of the quote-unquote committed crimes by whoever does it.
And the ministry has said that the Attorney General's office will be investigating those independently. But again, the UN, as well as the U.S., are saying that there need to be independent investigations and access that can enable that.
So where does that kind of access stand now?
On the humanitarian aid side, we've seen it open up a tiny bit, but even now some areas, especially rural areas in the region, remain restricted even to UN and UN-affiliated organizations. And that means that 4 months later, there's still some parts of the region that have been completely cut off. I mean, and it's not only humanitarian access that people are concerned about. People are also calling for international media to be allowed to be on the ground to report on this situation. Recently, the Ethiopian government has said that they would allow and that they have allowed some international media to travel to the region, which is a big change when you compare it to the beginning of the crisis. But then a couple days ago, Ethiopian journalists who worked for international media were arrested. And even though they've since been released, it kind of puts into question whether or not access is really going to be unfettered or whether it's going to be conditional.
The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, speaking to us from Nairobi. Thanks a lot, Halima.
Thanks, Carol.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. There's a new thing happening at some environmentally conscious companies, atoning for past pollution. That's today on The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
We've heard a lot about companies trying to address climate change and green their operations by using less energy or relying on renewable sources for power. Now, some companies are taking things a step further, addressing their historical greenhouse gas emissions. The World's Anna Kussmer reports on how one Dutch company is going about it.
If you have a skylight in your home, there's a decent chance it's made by Danish company Velux.
We basically invented what we call the skylight in the roof window as we know it today.
David Briggs is the CEO of the multi-billion dollar company, which has factories in 10 countries. Last year, the company decided it wanted to counteract all the planet warming pollution it's created making and selling windows since its founding.
Repaying completely our own historical carbon emissions so that by 2041, when we're 100 years old, we will have taken out of the atmosphere as much CO2 as we have put into it directly in that 100-year period.
But first, they needed to figure out exactly how much carbon pollution they've emitted over the years, starting from when they were a small Copenhagen workshop using hand tools in the 40s.
So we spent a lot of time figuring out how do we calculate, how the hell do we know how much CO2 we produced in 1964? So we developed a huge methodology to do that.
They came up with a number in gigatons of historical emissions. Then came the hard part, says Briggs, how to remove and store that same amount of pollution from the atmosphere. That's work they're starting now with the help of the Worldwide Fund for Nature in Denmark.
We were engaging with Velux because we think that it was the potential to raise funds for our forest conservation projects.
Sophie Tin Nielsen is senior forest advisor at WWF Denmark. Using money from Velux, her team is planning forest conservation projects in Uganda and Myanmar.
Where we are placing our projects where we have a biodiversity hotspot areas that we've identified, and then where there is high deforestation rates or high pressure on the forest.
Tin Nielsen says to help meet Velux's carbon goal, they plan a conservation project like they normally would.
And if we have to calculate the carbon and the company wants to make a claim, then fine.
In Myanmar, it's Gaurav Gupta's job to put the money towards saving trees and restoring forests.
What gets me up really in the morning to go to work is how we can make Myanmar a conservation success story.
In Paun Do Gi village in southeast Myanmar, thatch-roofed homes are nestled among palm trees. Stopping deforestation here is a complicated task, says Gupta. It starts by understanding what indigenous communities need and how they value the forests that surround them.
So first is really to do inclusive land use mapping and land use planning.
Gupta says the current plan with the Velux money is to help communities advocate for their land rights, plant nurseries, and patrol their forests to reduce illegal logging, and help people find markets for things that don't require the forest to be cut down, like a root vegetable called the elephant foot yam. Do Na Lele, who lives in Paun Do Gi, shows off a pile of the gray grapefruit-sized tubers in a video. She says the elephant foot yam is a blessing, the best thing they grow in the village. Gupta says to save and store carbon, you have to start by understanding people who live alongside the forest.
We are looking at the landscape level conservation, and this is just one block in the puzzle that we are putting together to address deforestation at the landscape level.
The work has been put on pause due to political instability in Myanmar, but Gupta says they're hoping to resume soon. The project is still in its infancy, and Velux CEO David Briggs admits it might be a niche solution.
I totally get that not every company can do what we are doing.
Velux has a relatively small carbon footprint to begin with and has the money to do this. This kind of project also faces some of the same problems as offset programs, where companies counteract their carbon emissions by paying for carbon storage somewhere else. It will be hard to know, for example, if forests protected by Velux might have stood anyway without their money. But the focus on historic emissions does help avoid some pitfalls, says Princeton University researcher Tim Searchinger.
If all you're doing is offset your historic emissions, then there's no downside, right? You're not, it's better to try than to do nothing. Because you're not emitting more because of that.
In addition to tackling its historical emissions, Velux plans to reduce its future emissions by 50% over the next decade. This focus on historic emissions could be good for corporate responsibility efforts, and it could also be a new way to fund conservation projects, says Marco Lambertini, Director General of WWF.
One of the exciting things of today is that there are new methodologies that allow for a much more rigorous and credible carbon accounting, both in terms of calculating the emissions of companies as well as calculating the compensation by protecting habitats like forests.
Lambertini says conservation can play a big role in limiting warming and avoiding the worst effects of climate change.
This project wants to demonstrate, and I hope will, that actually this is a super effective way to, in the menu of tools, to fight climate change.
Companies addressing past emissions could help fund a cooler future for everyone. For the World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
And now, another episode of Only on Public Radio. You might be thinking, okay, a shepherd's horn. Sure, I get that. Yes, but this one is frozen solid because it's made of ice. It's the specialty of Norwegian musician and composer Terje Isungset. He's been playing music with instruments made of ice for decades. Isungset likes to draw attention to the fragility of ice and the natural environment. His ice instruments come in all shapes and sizes. There are the horns, also string instruments with bodies made of ice, but actual strings. Then there are the ice percussions, again, totally made of ice. And here's a sort of ice xylophone called an isophone, naturally, also played by Isungset. Different notes are sounded by hitting different blocks of ice. Isungset strikes each one with his hands. You may also hear another bit of percussion in the background, a sort of chunka-chunka sound. That's a musician basically holding a giant mortar and pestle, all made of ice, and breaking up ice pieces inside it. All these sounds are from Isungset's performance at the Our Ocean Conference in Oslo 2 years ago. This year, he was scheduled to hold his annual ice music festival this past weekend, but sadly, the pandemic put that on hold. It will be held virtually, though, in a few weeks. And for those of you who just can't wait that long, here's a few more ice jams to tide you over. You're listening to The Sound of Ice on The World.
Marco here. We were blown away by the support we received during our 2020 fundraiser. Over 1,000 listeners made donations to support The World. People like Karen Clothier, Christopher Jensen, Julia Loomis, Casey Cole, Mark Guyando, Hillel Kolodner, George Perry, Jay Lai, Sharon Strothoff, and Susanna Fried. Thank you very much. Even though I'm unable to thank each person who donated, know that here at The World, we are forever grateful for every single one of you who continues to listen to the show.
During the pandemic, hobbies have exploded. In Turkey, the craze is all about training pigeons, then watching them race.
First, they start doing flip-flops, and then they're doing it like bulls.
Doing it like bulls, barreling toward the finish line. Also ahead, Europe's vaccination struggles, all on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. In Afghanistan, there's been a wave of deadly attacks targeting women. Human rights activists, journalists, and judges have been among those killed. This week, three young women were shot dead on their way home from work at a TV station in eastern Afghanistan. The militant group, the Islamic State, said its fighters are behind the killings. The Taliban is also suspected, but it is denying any involvement. Wajma Frok Cook is an Afghan women's rights activist. She co-founded the Women and Peace Studies Organization in Afghanistan in 2011 and joins me now from Washington. Wajma, who were these three women?
These three women, like young girls, they were actually not even 21, 20, 18, and 17 years of age. These are young girls who were in high school and who were doing translation of, you know, programs for young people in a local TV station.
Wajma, what was your reaction to the news of this latest attack?
You know, it's lots of outrage, fear, you know, like the girls who have been attacked. Like, I have sisters of the same age in my home, who go to school, who go to work, as so many other young women who work in my office, like 20 of the same young women are working in my organization who are like equally, you know, fearful for their life. So it's a deliberate attack on women to create more fear among women. And we never accept the fact, this claim that it's not the Taliban. Everybody in Afghanistan that you talk to understand that it's the Taliban, because they have given, you know, and space to almost every other criminal group in the community, and no other criminal group can actually or terrorist group can function without their support. So the fact that they keep denying makes no sense for us.
So you're saying you believe the Taliban is behind the actual killings, or the Taliban allowed ISIS to target these women?
It's both. The Taliban are behind it, because, you know, in areas where they have more influence. We just had, you know, attacks, similar attacks, and by the Taliban themselves, which they, you know, others have done that. They have killed, for example, just a couple of weeks back in Saripol, they killed a young woman because they accused her of supporting the government. Things like that keep happening, and the way the Taliban continue, you know, to terrify women and girls. This week, the kids, the girls, from grade 7 onwards, received letters under the logo of the Islamic Emirate of the of Afghanistan, which the Taliban are, that you are not allowed to go to school beyond grade 7. If you do, if something happens to you, you are responsible.
Now, of course, the other thing that's going on is the United States is continuing to negotiate with the Taliban to try to ensure a peaceful Afghanistan once all U.S. troops are withdrawn. Is there any evidence that these killings of women are intended to influence those negotiations in some way?
We wish at least there would be some accountability for these crimes on the ground. You know, if you accept that the Taliban are ready to negotiate, they have to show it in some level of, you know, actions that they do on the ground in terms of the killings, in terms of the attacks on Afghan communities. So if there is no such thing that one could believe that, okay, there is an impact of it, but, you know, like, we think that these attacks on women are being carried out by the Taliban as an attempt to make the communities ready for another Taliban return.
So what should the United States be doing in their negotiations with the Taliban? If you believe the Taliban are basically behind these killings of women, what should the U.S. be doing?
What is happening is that there is no accountability on this Taliban side. The U.S. has huge leverage on the Taliban. In the past year, no single American has been killed by the Taliban. What Afghans are asking is that the U.S. has leverage, has influence on the Taliban. So there has to be an embargo, sanctions on these ammunitions, on their sources of funding, all that money that comes to the Taliban from the region, all that, and their ability to move freely in the region and being able to mobilize.
Do you know if the U.S. is pushing for further protections for Afghan women in its negotiations with the Taliban?
So in terms of their messaging, yes, they are. But in terms of actions, you can see how that there is little in terms of the influence that they are making in terms of protection for women. And we are struggling with those rights right now.
Wajma Frook is an Afghan women's activist and co-founder of the Women and Peace Studies Organization in Afghanistan. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, we hear about the risks Afghans face who've assisted U.S. or NATO forces in their country. Many worked as interpreters and are now waiting for visas to leave Afghanistan because groups like the Taliban see them as traitors.
Me and my father, brothers are receiving calls from Taliban that we will be killed.
the deadly risks faced by those left behind in Afghanistan. That's tomorrow on The World. Italy has decided to play hardball with AstraZeneca. 250,000 doses of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine were slated to go to Australia, but the Italian government has blocked the shipment. It's citing rules set by the European Union last summer. Those guidelines say that vaccine exports can be stopped if a pharmaceutical company falls short of its obligations to the EU. The European Union's vaccine strategy was supposed to be a sign of unity, a stand against so-called vaccine nationalism. But months later, many EU countries have barely started vaccinating their own citizens. So what went wrong? And does this mean the EU project is in trouble? The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has our story.
Back in December, there was a real moment of celebration when Maggie Keenan became the first person in Britain to get the vaccine. Across the channel, though, the mood was less jubilant. One tabloid newspaper in Germany ran a snarky headline that said millions getting German vaccine, but we have to keep waiting. A month later, the EU did approve its first vaccine.
But now a problem looms. The AstraZeneca vaccine is likely to be approved for use in Europe later this week. But the company says Europe will not immediately get the number of doses that it's ordered and paid for.
This was a blow to the EU plan. Oxford AstraZeneca said it could only come up with a quarter of the doses ordered. European leaders were furious. The EU's health commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, said the manufacturer had let Europe down.
I call on AstraZeneca to engage fully, to rebuild trust, to provide complete information, and to live up to its contractual, societal, and moral obligations.
The idea behind Europe's vaccination programme is an admirable one. The EU Commission signed deals with six manufacturers to order enough doses for all 27 countries. This was supposed to mean that poorer EU nations wouldn't have to compete with their richer neighbours for vaccines. But French economist Nicolas Bouzou says EU negotiators made at least one big mistake, haggling for a cheaper price.
When the European Union said that it's great because we have negotiated the best price. No, it's not good because the price is not a problem. The only problem, this is to stop the pandemic.
The EU also pushed some of the legal risks onto manufacturers. They would have to take responsibility if something went wrong with vaccines, not EU governments, and this further delayed the negotiations. By mid-January, cracks in the strategy were really starting to show. First to break ranks was Hungary. Prime Minister Viktor Orban announced he was ordering 2 million doses of the Russian Sputnik vaccine. His government also decided to buy Chinese vaccines. Just this week, the Hungarian Prime Minister posted a Facebook video of himself getting the Chinese jab. Neither the Russian or Chinese vaccines have been approved by the EU. But Orban appealed to Hungarians to get the Chinese vaccine anyway. And it's not just Hungary that's defying the EU. The Czech Republic says it's in talks with China for vaccines. And Slovakia's prime minister was at the airport earlier this week to greet a cargo plane carrying the country's first doses of the Sputnik vaccine. All the while, EU officials have been defending the bloc's vaccination strategy. But French economist Nicolas Bouzou says there's no doubt its reputation has been damaged.
This is the strongest economic crisis for 80 years. So the vaccination campaign was the most crucial public policy for decades. And the European Union missed that.
Just today, the leaders of Denmark and Austria arrived in Israel. They're talking with the Israelis about developing a second-generation vaccine, one that can fight mutant strains of the virus. Daniel Hegedush of the German Marshall Fund says that potential alliance could irritate the EU, but it's the fact that EU governments are turning to authoritarian states that's most problematic.
There is a well-founded fear that both Russia and China are using vaccine diplomacy to undermine EU unity and to gain potential future influence over EU member states.
While all the backbiting and wheeling and dealing is playing out across the channel, Britain has powered ahead with its own vaccine programme. The UK's vaccination rate is now four times faster than the EU average. The UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock says Britain's success has a lot to do with one thing.
Because of Brexit, we've been able to make a decision to do this based on the UK regulator and not go at the pace of the Europeans, who are moving a little bit more slowly.
In fact, each of the EU countries could have adopted Britain's strategy, but they decided to stick together as a bloc. Supporters of the European Union's approach would say that Britain can hardly gloat. The UK's death toll from COVID-19 remains one of the highest worldwide. As Daniel Hegedush from the German Marshall Fund points out, Britain needs Europe to sort out its vaccine mess.
Ultimately, everyone is interested in Europe, including the United Kingdom as well, that the neighbours are able to control the spread of COVID-19, because that's the key to the relaunch of trade economy, which is important for everyone.
This week, Ursula von der Leyen, the EU Commission President, promised that things would be much better by the start of the summer. But with public anger boiling over, EU leaders are already paying a political price. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
This past year has been brutal. Globally, more than 2.5 million deaths from COVID-19. And then there's the other epidemic linked to the pandemic, loneliness and boredom. One silver lining to that, for some at least, more time to rediscover hobbies. Everything from baking sourdough to gardening. In Turkey, one thing that's seeing a revival is the ancient practice of raising pigeons. Duri Buskaran visited with one pigeon enthusiast in Istanbul and has this report.
7-year-old Kaman bounces up to the gate at the corner of a large grassy lot as he lets us inside. His father, Yalçın Karca, keeps a flock of 150 pigeons in Turabiye, a quiet residential neighborhood outside of downtown Istanbul. The air feels cleaner here, and a large sectioned coop stands to one side of the lot, like an elaborate cabinet. Through a translator, Karca says he's raised pigeons since he was a kid. But recently, in a time of COVID, the birds have become therapeutic.
And especially during quarantine, as we weren't able to go anywhere, we hung out in here a lot with my son, and it was therapeutic for him as well.
He feeds the birds a mixture of grain. Then he pulls out a plastic nest with two tiny chicks nestled in a bed of pine needles. They're covered in this sparse downy fluff, like tiny dinosaurs.
It's 3 days old.
Oh my goodness.
Their mother is a regal-looking bird with black and white plumage. Pigeons are thought to be one of the world's earliest domesticated animals, raised for food and fertilizer as early as 10,000 BC. They appear in Mesopotamian cuneiform tablets and Egyptian hieroglyphics. They helped early shipbuilders navigate the Mediterranean Sea and carried messages in wartime across the Central Asian steppes.
İletmek istediğin mesajı bacaklarına sarıp.
Karca explains that pigeons will always fly to the place they consider their home. So people would bring the birds on long voyages and use them to quickly send messages back.
When you just, stick a message to its foot, and it just takes the message there as if it's going home to its babies and to its own home. So the pigeon itself is not aware that they're doing it, but that's how it works.
Karca raises a specific breed of pigeon that today is somewhat rare, Salonique Donec Güvercin, which translates roughly to the rolling pigeons of Salonika. They were brought to Turkey after World War I. Most of Karca's pigeons are marked with a white head and tail feathers and a black torso, but with vivid, almost metallic hues of green and purple on their neck.
Yavaş yavaş önce geniş kanatlarla dönüyor. Ondan sonra
from a tall perch on top of an apartment block, they'll race to the ground as fast as possible, doing somersaults in the air as they gather momentum.
First, they start doing the white flip-flops, and then they start to narrow it down more and more, and then they're doing it like balls.
To teach the birds how to do this, Karca keeps another type of trainer pigeon. They're less flashy, Karca explains, but the most loyal species in the world. They'll never leave their home, and they keep the flock together.
Çok damarlı kuşlar, yani evinden
Trained pigeons can fetch thousands of dollars on auction sites. Last year, a Belgian racing pigeon was sold to an anonymous Chinese buyer for a record-breaking $1.9 million.
Birincil olmazsa olmayacak şart, hayvanları çok sevmesi lazım.
But Karja doesn't care about the money. To him, it detracts from what raising a pigeon is all about. Pigeons should be treated as part of the family.
The people who are trying to raise them for commercial purposes, it's not good because that means you're not really focusing on their health or like on their well-being. That's why it's not good for the pigeons.
To Karja, pigeon breeding is an art, but one that comes with a responsibility to provide them with a good life.
Senden bir parça gibi görmen lazım.
It's estimated there are 100,000 pigeon breeders in Turkey, maybe more. And all around the country, in the evening, around 6 o'clock, it's not unusual to see older men climbing up to the roof of an apartment building or to a coop tucked behind a family home. That's when they'll open the doors and let the birds out to stretch their wings. Flying together in a wide arc over the rooftops, in front of the setting sun. For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin, Istanbul.
As you're listening to The World, which is the result of the hustle and dedication of our producing team, stay connected with us and the stories we're chasing. We'll send you a quick email blast in the morning. Subscribe to our daily newsletter. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. In France, more than 600 academics have signed a letter calling for their nation's higher education minister to resign. That happened after the minister called for an investigation into the growing threat of what she called Islamo-leftism at French universities. But as Rebecca Rossman reports, people are having a hard time agreeing on what the term means.
Some say it's a threat to the French Republic. Others call it a bogus term that's casting a witch hunt. What is Islamo-gauchisme, or Islamo-leftism, and why is it suddenly the topic du jour in France? The academic Pierre-André Taguieff coined the term in the early 2000s to describe what he saw as a growing link between left-leaning academics and France's Muslim community. But over time, it came to mean something more pejorative.
I would say it started to be used in the public square, mostly in the context of the post-Charlie Hebdo and post-Bataclan attacks.
Nadia Marzouki is a fellow at France's National Center for Scientific Research. She says politicians from the right and left hijacked the term in 2015, following a string of terrorist attacks that shook the country and killed more than 140 people. This wasn't just a link, they said. Rather, they accuse certain academics of excusing the most violent interpretations of Islamist ideology, including terrorism.
Effectivement, il y a des gens qui peuvent utiliser leur titre et l'aura qu'ils ont.
The term came back into the spotlight last month when France's higher education minister Frédéric Vidal called for an investigation into Islamo-leftism at French universities, quote, so we can distinguish academic research from activism and opinion. But in a later interview, Vidal admitted she couldn't come up with a concrete definition for Islamo-leftism. Marzouki, who studies political Islam, says the murky messaging has made anyone studying the religion a target.
These statements came across as completely irresponsible and needlessly igniting fire and anger. They authorize a number of right-wing trolls on the internet to write blacklist and call for witch hunts.
Marzouki is one of 600 academics who have signed an open letter calling for Vidal's resignation, though that hasn't stopped the inquiry from going ahead. And according to a recent poll, 70% of the French population say they agree Islamo-leftism is a problem in France. A recent Le Monde editorial signed by 130 conservative intellectuals thanked Vidal for acknowledging the problem, but said she got the terminology wrong. It's not Islamo-leftism that's the issue, they wrote, so much as militancy disguised as pseudoscience. Audrey Celestine is a professor of American studies at the University of Lille. She says reactions like that undermine academia as a whole.
This is the opposite of like intellectual curiosity. It is really sort of France revealing the extent of its blind spots in terms of race, colonial history, etc.
There's also critics comparing the term to Judeo-Bolshevism, an anti-Semitic slur that blamed Jews for the spread of communism in the 1930s. Shlomo Sands, a professor at Tel Aviv University, was one of the first people to make the comparison.
My father was considered in Poland as a Judeo-Sovietic. It was a term that the anti-Semite used it in Poland, in Germany, and also in France.
Just like with Judeo-Bolshevism, Sands says the power of Islamo-leftism is that the term combines two seemingly negative things.
It's not only the gauchism, it's also the Islamism. Then together it's much more strong. Remember, the Nazis used a lot the term of Judeo-Bolshevism. The Nazis.
Now, he says, he feels like he's starting to see history repeat itself. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
In The Hague, in the Netherlands, there's an old postmaster's trunk. Inside, there are thousands of letters, sealed, never delivered, unread for hundreds of years. Until now. The World's Amanda McGowan has more.
Ever since humans have been sending each other messages, they've been thinking of ways to keep them secure from prying eyes. But before there was password protection or message encryption, before there were even envelopes, which weren't common until the 1800s, there was something called letter locking.
And that is when you take a piece of paper and you fold it up and you secure it so it becomes its own envelope. We've been doing that as humans for as long as we've been around.
That's Jana D'Ambrosio. She's a conservator at MIT Libraries in Cambridge, Massachusetts. If you're a historian trying to read a locked letter, you had to either break its seal or cut it open. That is, until now. Using high-tech scans and a specially designed computer algorithm, D'Ambrosio and her team were able to virtually unfold a letter written in the 1600s and read it without opening it.
I mean, it felt like being teleported 1,000 years into the future. It was astonishing. We were speechless, I think.
That's Daniel Smith, a lecturer at King's College London, who is part of this group called Unlocking History. They published their findings in Nature Communications this week. Their method starts with a high-resolution X-ray scan of the letter. Then, computer scientists developed an algorithm that could separate the layers of the folded pages. That allows them to read the text of the letter, but also to see all of its crease patterns. In other words, to learn how it was folded or locked. And if you're wondering why that might be important or interesting, listen to Nadine Ackerman from Leiden University, who studies early modern espionage.
Letter locking can be as unique as a signature. Spies definitely used it in that way. King Charles I wrote to one of his women spies that she had to use a certain lock and he knew would know her by the folding of her paper.
Maybe you're also wondering, if you want to know how a very old letter was folded, why not just open it? But sometimes the letter locking techniques were so complicated, slits cut here, pieces interlocked there, that by opening it, you could destroy it. Or you couldn't put it back together. Think about a folded piece of paper with a bunch of creases. You open it and see it flat, and then you want to fold it back together. Wait a minute, how did I do that again? It's hard to reconstruct. Here's D'Ambrosio demonstrating with a piece of paper.
These little crease patterns, once the letter's open, could fold up in a bunch of different ways. And once you open it up, this action is as ephemeral as a sneeze. Did it tuck in here or was it a fold and adhere? And that tells us something about their process.
By opening it, you could risk losing that process forever. But now, with 21st century technology, all secrets can be revealed. So the moral of the story is, if you really don't want anyone to read your letters, I guess you gotta burn them. For The World, I'm Amanda McGowan.
We've reached the end of this note. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow.